The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Monday, the 29th of October, 2018. On the podcast today, I have Jeremy Martin, Chief Executive Officer of Horizonte Minerals, HZM's ticker there, and Jeremy discusses the results of the feasibility study of the Araguaia ferronickel project in Brazil. Plus, Simon Rucker, founder and product director at Liberty Herbal Technologies, who are the owner of HAPAC, which Anana Developments, ANA ticker, owns a 15% share of. Also on the podcast, it's a Monday, so Malky, oil and gas sector specialist, talks about the following companies: Faro Petroleum, that's FPM, Eco Atlantic Oil and Gas, ECO, Rockrose Energy, RRE, and President Energy, PPC. And of course, as always, I have two lists, top fives of the most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see these lists on the front page of Vox, and there's top tens there, by the way, and that's voxmarkets.co.uk.
If you're looking to diversify your portfolio and allocate to unquoted companies, Rockball, one of our sponsors, offers growth equity and high-yield lending for established and profitable private companies. Investing can be tax efficient, and Rockpool Services is based on thorough due diligence and continual company monitoring. Capital at risk. Visit rockpool.uk.com or call 0203 8548 100.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Jeremy Martin, Chief Executive Officer of Horizonte Minerals. HZM is the ticker there. Jeremy, thanks for joining me.
Justin, good to speak to you again. How are you?
Good, thanks. Well, you must be pleased. I know a lot of work goes into a feasibility study, and finally, it's here. You've delivered it. So is it a big sense of relief there?
It's a major milestone for the company, yes. As obviously a number of your listeners will know, I mean, Horizonte is a AIM and TSX-listed company. We're focused in Brazil. We've got two assets. The asset we're talking about today is the Araguaia ferronickel project, and we've also got our second potential operation, the Vermelho nickel cobalt project. But today's release is covering the feasibility study on Araguaia. So yes, it's a big milestone for the company.
I've got to say, Jeremy, you're a consummate professional. I was going to say for people not aware of the company, give us a brief intro. You did it there seamlessly. So let's go straight into the feasibility. So you've released it. These things take ages to create and to produce. So take us through some of the highlights, if you could, Jeremy, of the feasibility study.
Yeah, absolutely. So, first of all, I think it's worth just refreshing on the journey. I mean, Araguaia is a discovery that Horizonte, our team, made 8 or 9 years ago. We then acquired the adjacent new discovery from Teck Resources, Canada's largest mining company. And then we consolidated the northern half of the district and acquired the asset from Glencore, or Xstrata Glencore. So this has been a journey from discovery, consolidation, advancing the assets through scoping study, pre-feasibility, and obviously finally the feasibility study. And it is a big milestone. It marks the transition from really being a junior exploration company now moving into the development arena. So it's a big step. Yes, the feasibility study has been an involved piece of work. We originally planned to release this early this year, and we've extended that timeline and obviously released it today. And the main reason behind that is we really wanted to make sure as a board that what we delivered was a very high quality study. The level of detail and also we added into the process the ability to add a second RKEF line into the operation, allowing us to double nickel production from 14,500 tons up to 29,000 tons. And we saw that as a big step, being able to show to the market that this is a scalable asset. So, yeah, very pleased to have it out into the market. Key headline economic numbers. It generates a net present value of over $400 million, an internal rate of return of over 20%, and it generates over $1.6 billion of free cash flow over life of mine. So it is a tier one asset. It'll also be low cost. the C1 cost, which is a measure of the cost of producing nickel, will be around $8,190 a ton, which means it'll be one of the lowest cost nickel laterite operations in the world. And it is a very robust, compelling set of economics.
Yeah. Well, for people liking the sound of this, but are not aware of, you know, where nickel is or the future of nickel and the profile of it, can you just go through the background? What's the outlook for nickel?
Yeah, I think nickel is a very exciting space. I mean, it's had 10 years of very tough conditions where we were trading at historically low prices. If we went back when we released the pre-feasibility study, which was nearly 3 years ago, nickel was trading at around $7,000 to $7,500 a ton, which was at that point 14, 15 year lows in the nickel price. And then Q2 this year, we saw nickel price moving up towards $15,000 a ton. And the year-to-date average is around 13,600 this year. So it's come up from a very low base. If you go back 10, 15 or beyond that, we saw nickel hit $50,000 a ton with sort of longer-term averages of around $20,000 a ton. If you look at the space now, we've seen nickel come up, as I said, in the last 3 years. The key drivers are demand. Strong demand. It's growing at around 2 to 3% midterm, and that's mainly from the stainless steel sector because 70% of nickel goes into stainless steel. But the really exciting new development is in electric vehicles, and that's obviously a massive growth market, and nickel is used in the batteries in those vehicles. We've also had another key factor, which is really come into the marketplace in the last 12 to 18 months, where we've seen nickel inventory. This is metal held on exchanges, and it's in London on the London Metal Exchange and on the Shanghai Futures Exchange. We've seen the amount of nickel held in inventory come down, and we've now reached a point where the inventory is at levels not seen for the last 5 years. So robust demand, nickel inventory is drawn down, and there are very few big projects out there that can come online in the midterm, and Araguaia is in a unique position being one of those assets. And if you take, you asked me about what sort of mid to long term pricing is, Wood Mackenzie, who is a major metals price forecasting group, are looking at now $26,000 a ton for their long term incentive nickel price. So it's a compelling space to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got this done. So what's the next sort of big milestone here then at Araguaia?
So obviously study complete today. The next milestone will be the award of the issue of our construction license, which we're working to get later this year, stroke early next year. And then obviously the feasibility study marks the start of the funding process to put together the construction financing package. And we're getting very strong interest from the private equity arena, from the offtake sector, and also from the commercial debt providers. So combination of construction permit, building up the project finance, so we aim to be in a position mid next year so we can actually start building Araguaia as an operation.
Yeah, and as far as, you know, the country you're in, Brazil, I know it's had its problems of late with the economy and stuff like that, but what's it like there, what's it like to operate there?
Well, I'm obviously slightly biased because I'm heavily invested down there, but I wouldn't be if I didn't think it was a great place to operate. We're up in northeastern Brazil in a state called the Pará State. It is a mining dominated region. You've got the Carajás mining district, 100 kilometers north of Araguaia, and that's where Vale have all of their big iron ore operations. They've got ferronickel, they've got copper. And as a result of that, the infrastructure is extremely good. You've got surfaced highways, you've got railways, you've got hydroelectric power. It's an extremely good region in terms of infrastructure. Very good proactive government support on both the environmental and permitting. And the other key thing is, yes, Brazil has come out of a very deep recession, but it's still a very compelling place in terms of the real dollar rate at the moment. And I think going forwards, it's going to be a strong investment destination. We're obviously going through the election process at the moment, but overall a very good place to operate. And more importantly, from a nickel point of view, it's got some of the highest grade nickel laterites out there today and three producing nickel laterite operations. So it's got know-how, it's got the skill base, everything you want when developing a new mine.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, one final thing, Jeremy. If someone's listening to this, likes the sound of it, but are not yet following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Number one, the feasibility study results have demonstrated that there is significant value within the Araguaia project to be built out, which will be developed as we go forwards. Number two, you've got a second tier one asset, the Vermelho Nickel Cobalt project, which we acquired from Vale at the start of this year. Vale had spent around $200 million on that project, and we acquired that right at the bottom of the market for a compelling acquisition price. So that gives us potentially mine number two. So between Araguaia and Vermelho, we have the potential to build a very significant nickel business. We've got some strong shareholders around the company. We've got likes of JP Morgan, Teck, Glencore. So you've got a very solid register. And we've got a strong cash position. Last reported cash position was around $8 million. And finally, we're developing this project into a compelling nickel market. So all of the factors that you're looking for, we can offer investors. Obviously a challenging time in the market at the moment. We've had a tough 6 months for the metal space. But I think as we go into next year, we're going to see renewed interest and start to create some real value.
Marvellous stuff, Jeremy. Good to chat to you. Hopefully we'll be catching up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Simon Rucker, founder and product director at Liberty Herbal Technologies, which is the owner of HAPAC, which Ananda Development, listed on the NEX, of course, ANA is ticker there, owns 15% share of. Simon, thanks for joining me this morning.
Thank you very much, Justin. Good morning.
Now, first and foremost, I mean, we've had Melissa on, and she talked about the deal with you guys and her investment in your company. But just to go over again, what is HAPAC?
Well, HAPAC is a new technology. HAPAC, the word, stands for Herb and Paper Anti-Combustion. Essentially, it's a technology.
Yeah.
And it's a technology for vaporizing herb. Okay. And people will be familiar with some of the tobacco heating products out there, IQOS, British American Tobacco's Glow products. Mm-hmm. And the basic technology is similar. Rather than burning leaf or herb, you heat it to release the compounds that you want to consume. And you know, you see that, as I said, in the tobacco market with these harm reduced products that allow smokers to switch to a harm reduced platform. Get the nicotine, the taste they want, but without any of the combustion.
Yeah, yeah. But it's herbal. So what are you aimed at here? What are you doing here with HAPAC?
Well, our current focus is cannabis. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of reasons why it's a good focus for us, because I mean, it's a very dynamic market. It's a new market. In some ways, the regulations are still being formed, considered, thought about. And there's a chance to do a lot of things better, I think, than the way tobacco is currently being regulated and managed. And also there's a chance for small companies like us to really get in and stand a chance. I mean, the reality is there's an awful lot of small e-cigarette companies in the tobacco market, but they struggle against the power of the big tobacco companies who now effectively own or control most of the major e-cigarette brands. So I think we just saw it as a great opportunity to both bring our technology to market without having to raise huge amounts of capital, but also a brilliant place to develop it as well, because we can get, we can do things quickly, we can be agile, and also I think people are much more open to new technologies. There's a lot less sort of emotional baggage, shall we say, around cannabis. Obviously, it's not an uncontroversial category, but I think people, certainly view cannabis more favourably than they do tobacco, typically.
Yeah. And like I say, it's a massive market opening up, isn't it? There's so many benefits that, it's been tainted, for a long time, cannabis, as just a drug, a recreational drug. But to me, there's huge benefits that are becoming evident now, aren't there?
Well, yes, absolutely. And I think that really is our focus. Mm. I mean, long term, of course, we wouldn't say no to being let's say a key technology in the recreational markets, but I think only when they have been proven to be responsible, well managed, well regulated. I think medical makes a lot of sense for us. I mean, simply for the fact that the majority of cannabis consumed for medical purposes is still smoked, which is dumb. Mm-hmm. If you think about this, you're a patient, you have a condition, and you are being prescribed medical cannabis, and then effectively you're being asked to roll the joint. And that really was our inspiration, was, you know, we looked at this market, we saw what a kind of weird situation that was, and realized that there was a terrific opportunity for the type of technology we were developing. You know, it gives patients and consumers what they want, which is access to high quality natural herb. There's still a massive preference for that versus, you know, some of the more processed or more synthetic products, but without any of the downsides of smoking. And it's also, it's a very convenient product. And essentially it's a portioned, small portioned bag made from filter paper of precisely ground cannabis flower. So, you know, we are bringing this sort of dosed, convenient, much cleaner, much less risky form of cannabis to people who would otherwise be smoking it.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, this is, I mean, you are the founder of you know, Liberty Herbal Technologies. So is this your main focus at the moment? And why did you decide to, you know, create Liberty Herbal Technologies?
Well, as I said, I think we just saw a terrific opportunity.
Yeah.
And I think we recognize that the technology is suitable for the tobacco market and providing a better alternative to smoking or even e-cigarettes for consumers out there who want to continue consuming nicotine. But I think the opportunities, as I said, with cannabis were just difficult to ignore. I realized fairly early on that, I mean, my background, as I said, is product development. I've done a lot of work for big sort of FMCG companies, consumer electronics companies, you know, the likes of Unilever, Samsung, Diageo, and then latterly British American Tobacco. I've done a lot of work with them, in fact, in the last 10 years, helping them rethink what their corporate strategy should be, and helping develop the products that currently make up a lot of their harm-reduced product portfolio, the e-cigarettes, the tobacco heating products that they're currently selling and trying to bring to market. So I've got a lot of experience in this area. In some ways, there are not many people around the world who've got as much experience as I have in developing these types of products. So I suppose it gave me a natural edge when thinking about doing a product like Hatback. I think we also realized that big companies do sometimes struggle trying to bring new technology and products to market. And actually what they're a lot happier doing is letting smaller companies do it to prove the market traction, to iron out the wrinkles, to, you know, establish a decent intellectual property portfolio. And then a large company will very happily come in and buy that entity.
Yeah.
So I think our strategy is very much sort of geared towards, you know, longer term being acquired by a large company. I think the interesting thing is that obviously a lot of other industries that appear to be interested in cannabis, and you'll probably be aware of Constellation Brands hoovering up 10% of Canopy Growth recently for a very large sum. So I think a lot of people see cannabis as either a next growth area or as a strategic play to prevent cannibalization of existing sales and things like alcohol and tobacco.
Yeah. And so who else is joining you there on this journey at Liberty?
Well, I essentially set up the company with two other guys, both ex-British American Tobacco senior executives, one from the marketing and innovation side, one from the, say, brands and commercial side. So Mark Waterfield has been the president of BAT Indonesia, I believe. I think that's right. And he was the global head of brands at British American Tobacco before he retired. And Domenico Ventura is somebody I actually worked with at British American Tobacco back in the day. And he was the global head of innovation for essentially what we call next generation products. So there's the tobacco heating, the e-cigarette type products I've mentioned before. And he left, and I think we realized that here was a chance for us to do something together. I'd been running essentially a JV, a creative agency, an innovation agency called IJ Couture in London, in partnership with the Canadian company IJ Couture. And I just decided it was about time that I, you know, did my own thing and actually made my own products rather than advising big companies what to do. I should. You know, take some of my own medicine and, as I said, sort of create something that a large company could look or be interested in acquiring.
Yeah. And so it's very interesting. I mean, quickly, you say there, You know, it's little sachets that you'd go into sort of vaporizer. And so the alternative at the moment is just what? Just like you said, burning it, smoking it. That what happens?
Well, I think at least, I mean, even in, let's say, highly developed legal markets, Washington State is a good example, or Colorado, where you've effectively had access to cannabis legally, either as a patient through medical channels or more recently through recreational channels, essentially in a kind of model that's very similar to how you would buy alcohol or cigarettes, you know, age-verified portal, and sort of taxed and regulated in a similar way. But as I said, the majority of that cannabis is still smoked. Mm-hmm. It is still by far the most popular way of doing it because it's the way that people are familiar with. You know, when cannabis was an illegal product, it was largely consumed in bongs, joints, pipes, etc. And so people are kind of, you know, some people are nostalgic for that. You know, they may have smoked it legally in the past and they want sort of more of the same. But increasingly, there are new emerging product categories around vaporization and what are called edibles or ingestibles, or even some topical products, you know, skin creams and things like that. But I think the really big news, frankly, is in the vapor products. As I said, these are products where you're not burning the cannabis, you're simply using heat or other techniques, but typically heat to create a vapor from either the herbal cannabis itself or from an extract from the herbal cannabis, which typically takes the form of an oil or a liquid. And we're seeing tremendous interest and growth in those vapor products.
Go on, sorry.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that the big, let's say, competitor for us are essentially e-cigarettes that contain cannabis oil or some kind of cannabis-infused liquid. Yeah. Now, obviously, if you are a producer and you're looking for something other than simply selling people herb to smoke, then e-cigarettes are an obvious technology to kind of jump onto. And so what you see in the market now, they're known as vape pens. But they have essentially a lot of the same problems that e-cigarettes have. And that's not least that they are essentially quite a synthetic product. And in order to create the extract, the oil, you have to extract that from the herbal cannabis. And that requires the use of solvents, either butane or supercritical CO2, among others. And that's quite a dangerous process. I mean, it's not a, you know, we're simply grinding our cannabis, not doing anything very, very, very dangerous with it. But extraction is highly technically demanding and it's expensive. I mean, the equipment used to extract oil typically costs from $500,000 upwards to be able to sort of, you know, actually do it properly. And as I said, you know, it does denature a lot of the kind of delicate phyto chemicals, and that's essentially the sort of the umbrella term for the cannabinoids, the terpenes that people are actually after. Mm-hmm. And these are the things that provide both the benefits and also the taste profile that patients and consumers enjoy. And, you know, our product essentially is largely natural. Yeah. The filter paper, little sachets it comes in, are paper, you know, cellulose. And what you're putting in it essentially is cellulose. And what you're left with at the end of it is largely cellulose. And these little sachets come out where there's no combustion, so they pop out. And the analogy is a bit like a tea bag, but obviously there's no liquid involved here, just hot air. Mm-hmm. So it's a much more environmentally friendly technology. There's no, you know, large amounts of energy required to extract the cannabis, to make the extracts. The packaging technology itself is fairly, you know, fairly simple and doesn't require a huge amount of energy. We're not doing much to the cannabis itself. And the resulting product has a much lower environmental impact than a lot of these oils and liquids, which had to be packaged and distributed in plastic packaging. Again, you know, it's increasingly a no-no these days. Mm-hmm. But also I think the other thing that we realize, and this is a lot to do with my experience in working for tobacco companies, is that things like cigarettes are made faster and cheaper than literally anything else on the planet. Yeah. And e-cigarette companies struggle to provide a product that has the same economies of scale and efficiencies that essentially a herbal product does. So I think we see a terrific opportunity in bringing in a new wave of industrialization to this burgeoning cannabis space that provides terrific benefits for, as I said, the patients and consumers. It's convenient. It's a very good conversion rate of the cannabinoids. When you smoke cannabis, you typically lose around 50 to 60% of what you bought, you know, the expensive stuff. It just literally goes up in smoke. Whereas with ours, you're getting 80 to 90% of the available cannabinoids and terpenes. And, you know, it's convenient, it's clean. It means you don't have to clean the vaporizer oven as much as you would be if you're using loose herb. It's also, importantly, it provides a moment. It provides a defined consumption. And it's a dosed product, so it's much easier for consumers and patients to regulate, to control how much they're consuming.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of the benefits for the consumer. And then you've got the terrific benefits for the producers. Like I said, it's a highly efficient process. Very little gets wasted. It's environmentally friendly. There's low energy inputs. And then I think regulators and public health have expressed a lot of interest in this product because, as I said, all the benefits it has for the patients and all the benefits of efficiency that it brings producers. But mainly for them, it's seen as being a responsible product. We're not concentrating the cannabinoids, so we're not creating an overly strong product that many people see as being irresponsible. But we are providing essentially what patients want, what manufacturers want, and what the public health and regulators seem to want as well.
Okay, Simon, so for people sort of not aware, you know, where are you focused? What are you focused on doing?
Well, I think we're focused on doing something, and perhaps a good analogy here is the way the coffee market has developed over the last 10, 15 years. I mean, if you wind back to the 90s, in most markets you had a ground coffee market. So in America, you know, the standard sort of coffee machine, the sort of cup of joe. Not really much in the way of instant coffee, but some of it. But the rest of the world, you had a kind of ground coffee market and you had an instant coffee market. And instant coffee was the big technological development in the 50s or 60s. And then obviously what appeared were these capsules. You know, Nespresso, everyone would be familiar with Nespresso, but of course there's Dolce Gusto, there's Tassimo, there's all these different brands, different types of format. But they're all essentially pre-portioned ground coffee products that bring a huge amount of convenience. So rather than having to grind your beans and you know, put them in a French press or a cafetière of some sort and then add the water and then the mess of cleaning all that up, you're getting the same convenience largely as you do with instant coffee with these pods. And essentially that is the analogy for something like HAPAC. We're like the Nespresso of cannabis. I think I mentioned before that, you know, we're not unlike a tea bag in format. And essentially, that's what we're bringing. We're bringing that premium natural quality, but with the convenience that people, you know, associate with instant coffee. And I think that's what you see in cannabis at the moment. You see a lot of ground coffee aficionados, and essentially people who like the real deal. They like rolling joints. They like all the paraphernalia and the sort of old, so let's call it the hippy dippy trippy sort of culture behind it. Mm. And then you've got this emerging space of people who love the convenience of the vape pens. But as I said, these vape pens typically use quite a denatured product inside them, this extracted cannabis oil or liquid. So we see this space of natural vaping, convenient natural vaping, as being very much like you know, the market for pods. And in the US, they call Keurig K-Cup. I think that's the analogy there. I think the second analogy, which is probably interesting for your listeners, is really how the tobacco industry developed. If you go back to the late 19th century, there was a guy called James Buchanan Duke, who was the son of a tobacco producer. And he essentially took over his father's company with his brother and saw the opportunity in a machine invented by a guy called James Bonsack. And James Bonsack basically created the first automated cigarette making machine. And he had effectively solved the problem that had arisen because Philip Morris was the guy who basically first introduced cigarettes to the tobacco market. And he did that in the UK a bit earlier. And I think it was late 1875, I think it was. But these were all hand-rolled products. And so there was a massive limit to how quickly they could be produced. James Bonsack solved that problem by creating this automated cigarette-making machine. James Buchanan Duke saw the opportunity in that and effectively acquired the license for it in the States. That's 1885. By 1890, he controlled 90% of the US cigarette market under what was then called the American Tobacco Company. And he then turned his attention to the British market, and that intense competition forced the creation of Imperial Tobacco. out of the various existing British manufacturers. And then 2 years later on, an agreement was reached whereby American Tobacco controlled essentially the American trade, Imperial Tobacco controlled the British territories, and a third joint venture, British-American Tobacco, controlled the sale of tobacco to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. So I think we see potentially history repeating itself, that in creating what we see as being this technology platform that kind of it sits in the sweet spot of both what consumers want, processors want, and regulators and public health want, there is a chance to do the same thing to the cannabis industry that happened to the tobacco industry 120 years ago. The big difference, obviously, is ours is not a combustible product. You know, it's a vaporized product, massively lower emissions. I wouldn't go so far as say it's a healthy product, but it is certainly a much, much better product for you than smoking. So I think it's got a terrific chance to to take a large slice of this emerging market.
Yeah. So you've got the product, you've got seemingly the expertise, you've got good guys who've worked with big companies.
We hope so.
So where are you at the moment, and where, you know, commercially, what's happening?
Well, in the last couple of years, we've been establishing our intellectual property and obviously testing, prototyping, testing the product a lot. We've done research in the West Coast of America, but we've also been trialing it in Europe. And we are in the process of essentially setting up a pilot plant and doing a pilot launch in Italy. Italy is a very interesting market. It's very much focused on herbal products. E-cigarettes are, of course, available, but they're not really, let's say, they're not as popular as they are in many markets. Europe is an interesting market generally because it essentially is lagging behind North America.
Yeah.
Obviously, various countries are scrabbling to catch up and sort of establish some sort of decent regulatory environment around medical cannabis. I think a lot of politicians, regulators, and public health in those countries are recognizing the benefits and the potential of cannabis, medical cannabis, and that's the starting point for most of these countries. But Italy has both a medical cannabis market; it also has what's known as an industrial hemp market. And that effectively is just a low THC cannabis product. THC is the cannabinoid that people are largely familiar with in terms of the controlled substances. It's the one that's regulated along with another cannabinoid called CBN. And the Italian market allows the sale of low THC cannabis products. And that's why it's a great place for us to go and let's say, beta test both our industrial platform, our business model. I mean, we're essentially a non-herb touching technology. We license our technology, both for manufacture and sale, to existing license holders or companies who have basically acquired the licenses to legally grow, produce, process, and sell cannabis. And as like I said, it's a great market for us to go and try things out and fine-tune our package.
Yeah.
And once we're happy with that, then it's not exactly a matter of cutting and pasting it to different markets, but we will have worked out a lot of, let's say, the model and be able to transfer it with much more easily to places like Canada, which we're planning to go into in 2019. We're also looking carefully at, obviously, what's happening in the UK. Obviously, I think the shift in policy caught a lot of people unawares. We thought the UK would probably lag behind a lot of European countries, but it seems to be sort of leapfrogging.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously Germany. Germany's a great market and great potential for our product there as well.
Yeah. I mean, is it any way of knowing the potential size of the market? Do you have an idea of the target or what?
Well, I think there's lots of ways that you can extrapolate from existing data. I think you can also look at what's happened in, let's say, markets like Canada, and that gives you a fairly good indication of how, not only the kind of the market size. I mean, typically, let's start with what people know for a long time, which is that even in illegal markets, you know, at least 1-2% of the adult population are consuming cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not a small amount of people. It's a very large amount of cannabis being consumed. When you get into the legal markets, and you're getting between 10 and 15% of the adult population consuming cannabis on a regular basis, we're then estimating that our technology could take 1% of that market. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's, again, that's based on a lot of different variables, but obviously we're watching very closely how quickly people are making the transfer from smoked cannabis to these alternative products, the vaporized products, ingestible products, the edibles, etc. And we're just looking at what we believe were our benefits, essentially offer something very credible, very, very persuasive to those consumers who are making that shift from smoking it to other, let's say, reduced risk platforms, or more sort of socially acceptable platforms.
Okay. Well, Simon, it's a lot of information, very good, but to summarise, if you could, give us three reasons why someone listening to this right now is not following the story of Ananda, who are, of course, invested in you, why they should hit that follow button on their page, please, and add them to the watch list.
Well, I think Ananda have done something very bold. I mean, they have created one of the two listed vehicles on the UK stock exchanges that are focused primarily on cannabis. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that gives UK investors an opportunity to get into this kind of green rush. Now, obviously, this is not we're not talking about necessarily growing and all the stuff that characterized the opportunities in North America. This is very much the second wave, the wave of industrialization and downstream value-add technologies and brands, which is really what we're focused on. So I think they give UK investors a terrific access to this global opportunity. And I mean, I probably should say a little bit about what Ananda has done. I mean, as you mentioned, they took 15% stake in Liberty Herbal Technologies. But Melissa Sturgis, who's an executive director of Ananda, is also going to sit on Liberty's board. And Ananda also has the first right of refusal on any future raise for the next 2 years. So I think they see this as being a great opportunity. They really believe in us. And I think also Ananda gives a kind of stamp of approval to a British technology product, which you know, I think has a terrific potential in the global cannabis market.
Marvellous stuff. Simon, it's good to chat to you. And hopefully we'll be chatting again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now, it's Malky, oil and gas sector specialist. You all right, fella?
I'm extremely well, thanks, Justin. And you?
Good. So, yes, I'm all right. Do you know what? I do like this kind of weather. I mean, if we're going to have cold weather, I don't mind, as long as it's not rainy. I do like a blue sky and sun. It is a bit chilly, but that's winter, you know? It's the preferable scenario for me, you know, a nice sort of crisp but sunny day, but cold, you know? I like that. But
Me too.
Yeah. Okay, so any news there? What's happening there, Mark, in the oil and gas sector?
Well, I mean, the oil price is actually, you know, it came back a bit last week. But to be fair, 67 for West Texas and 77 for Brent crude is not bad at all. And, you know, I mean, the question is, it's as I've said before, it's a difficult fourth quarter. In a week's time, Iran will be no longer able to produce and sell its oil on international markets. And I think most people will behave according to plan, but I think quite a lot of that has been taken into account already. And in the first and second quarters of next year, supply will be better. And from what it looks like, there's a bit of worry about global GDP. So I think, you know, OPEC plus, you know, Saudis and the Russians are going to have to get together and cut back production a little bit at that stage. But we'll wait and see. But you know, at these prices, oil companies are doing very well indeed. Thank you very much. And we'll find out that, because this week marks the week that the oil majors produce their results. So we have BP tomorrow and Shell on Thursday and Exxon and Chevron on Friday. So, you know, they will be bumper figures, as they say.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and as far as specific news from companies, what anything out there?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a few bits and pieces around. I wanted to talk about Faroe Petroleum because, as it goes, it's probably one of the best, if not the best, managed and companies in the UK oil and gas sector, and has a fantastic record of buying acreage, exploring successfully, developing And they've got a great portfolio with lots to come, well financed. And the financing bit is has been accentuated this morning. They've announced they've increased and extended the duration of their RBL, that's their reserve-based lending, to underpin their growth plans. They had a 250 million RBL before with 100 million of an accordion. So now that they're effectively exercising the accordion, they've got 350 million to draw down, and they've extended that from 2023 to 2025. So that, you know, they are gearing up. But you will remember, I think, that during the summer that DNO. Made a raid on their shares. They bought shares from Delek and they added them by buying in the marketplace. And so they've got about 28% of Faro shares. And as of the 4th of October, they're entitled to go out and do some more. So although this announcement this morning is perfectly normal, run-of-the-mill oil company sort of treasury administration, in my view, they're certainly gearing up to make sure that they've got everything covered. And as they say, they want to be fully fit for purpose. And, of course, supporting the company's, you know, as they always do, strategic aims and continuing growth plans. And I would add to that, and the ability to repel all borders when rather than if DNO come visiting to try and take over the company on the cheap. Mm-hmm. This announcement today looks to me like they've been working on another chapter of the defence document, because when DNO come along to try and buy a significantly less impressively managed business than they are themselves, you want to make sure that the shareholders you don't want to appear to be on the back foot. So I think this is Faro quite sensibly getting their act together, should that happen.
Yeah. A nice little uptrend in the chart. It's been doing well, hasn't it? It's been really strong.
Yeah, and this company, to be honest, Justin, is, you know, obviously it's very well run. The shares went up quite dramatically when DNO came into the process, and they've stayed up, and they keep going up because, you know, the bottom line is that DNO got the first 28% on the cheap. Mm-hmm. So I would say, you know, you want to make sure that they don't get taken out at all, but of course the shareholders will say, you know, what is the price at which they'll be able to get taken out? And certainly, given that they got the first lot at sort of a quid or just over, I would say you'd want to massively increase than this for the remaining 72%.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Marvellous stuff. That's FPM. Anything else, Malky?
Yeah, one or two things. Eco Atlantic, which I've mentioned before, and, you know, this thing, you know, could probably come into the category as one of the cheapest stocks in the sector by a million miles, because obviously they've got acreage in Namibia and they've got, more importantly, acreage in Guyana, which you remember me talking about before. And the shares have been good performers, of course, but you know, there was an announcement last week that Tullow, who fell off their partnership with Tullow in both Namibia and Guyana, Tullow have done what they call sort of prioritization of their drilling portfolio activities, and have handed back effectively the Namibia stuff in order to concentrate on Guyana. And that's quite right, because their acreage is adjacent to Exxon's acreage in the area, and they intend to develop that quite quickly. So the bottom line here is that in order to do this, they're going to accelerate the work program. They're already talking about adding another well to the program next year, and you know, I think that we're going to see a lot of action here. Now, the eco market cap is like 66 million quid. And even you know, with the having them farmed out to Total, they've got an enormously valuable piece of real estate in Guyana, and at some stage over the next few months, it's the market are going to work out just how much that is worth, and I think they'll be fighting off suitors to buy, you know, their stake in this in this company for a long time to come.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, I'm getting the guys. It was supposed to be on last week, but for some reason couldn't do it in last week. But hopefully, I'll have Gil on the podcast this week sometime. But
I'm sure he will. It'll be a very exciting call as well.
Mm-hmm. And what's next, Malcolm? Anything else?
I want to mention Frontier. Just a couple of quick ones. Frontier have been saying for some time that that the majors that they have been talking to in their Georgia Block 12, and they've announced this morning that the major they're concerned is Baker Hughes, one of the biggest service companies in the world. And they are going to be coming into what they call enhance their service capacities, and they're commencing infield drilling and intervention. They've got an exciting campaign in their three fields in Georgia. They hope to increase production and increase oil recovery. Resources in that country are substantial, and this is probably just the sort of thing they need to do to make sure they're in good nick. And I think that my feeling is that this will do them a power of good to have Baker Hughes working with them in country, and so that's very positive news for Frontier. A couple of other quick ones. Announcements have been made. I noticed that you and I have talked about Rock Rose Energy before.
Yeah.
And they announced last week that they were tendering to buy back 20% of their own stock. Now, this doesn't happen very often, as you know, because it's one of those things in the market where companies are usually spending the money they've got on their programs and so on. But Rock Rose have clearly decided, and they've got money in the bank and nothing to do with it at the moment, that their own stock is the cheapest stock in the marketplace.
Yeah.
And it's quite a brave move. Actually, the shares have run up a bit, and I think that one might expect to see, it's difficult to tell whether people will tender their stock. Some of the people who've been in for some time and who were probably part and parcel of the corporate deals they did in order to get this far, well, might find that they do sell it at this level. If not, I think that if they get it, then they'll be in an even stronger position, as will the he's actually the chairman, Andrew Austin, who will have an increased percentage stake in this company. I think that, it's always exciting when a management decides that their own stock is the cheapest and they're going to go buy it themselves, mm-hmm. whether it's PA or indirectly PA. And I think it's well worth keeping a very close eye on.
Yeah, well that's right, though. I mean, do they still see it as cheap? Because it's risen quite strongly, isn't it?
Yeah, well, they clearly do. I had a long chat with Andrew Austin last week, and he said the board have decided that at 560p, which is a 20% increase to the 60-day VWAP, that the shares are still phenomenally cheap. So, mm-hmm. There you go.
Yeah, cool. RRE, ticker there.
Yeah.
Anything else, Maggie?
Just briefly, I noticed that President Energy, we talked about last week, I think, mm-hmm. announced two things. They spudded the second well in the three-well drilling campaign and said that the first well will be on stream by the time the second one is finished, which will then go on to the third. That's going to add a minimum of 600 barrels a day to the existing 2,700 barrels a day. So a very strong position indeed there. And they've announced this morning their third quarter results, which are extremely good indeed. Turnover's up 20%, adjusted EBITDA is up 100%. Yeah, as you might expect, they're bringing on production, very high oil prices, but they're also, generating cash significantly. I've talked about this before, and the costs are coming down every time they do something. So, they're in a very strong position at the moment. the figures demonstrate what presidents have been saying to us on an operating basis for some time, and I think it means that this is another share which is phenomenally cheap if you look at the amount of money they're getting in from revenue from the continually increasing well stock that's delivering the goods. So President is in very strong condition as well, mate.
Yeah. PPC, is that right? I think ticker there?
Yep.
Yeah.
That's cool, great. Cool.
Marvellous stuff. And anything else there, Maggie?
That's all. Thank you very much for the moment, Justin.
Lovely. Well, listen, we'll catch up next week, fella. Thanks for that.
Okay,
it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Live Company Group, LVCG. At four, Bidstack, BIDS. At three, Anglo African Oil and Gas, AOG. At two, Alpha Growth, that's ALGW. And number one most followed company on Vox Markets is IQAI Limited. Ticker there, of course, is IQAI. Well, I did chat about that on the weekend podcast, and I mentioned also Bidstack, which I don't hold stock in, and of course Live Company Group, which is there as well. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, N4 Pharma, Nuvec, research update. At four, EVR Holdings, Melody VR signs agreement with Ibiza Rocks Group. At three, Greatland Gold, GGP, large new geophysical target at Saddle Reefs. At two, Frontera Resources. Frontera signs MOU with industry major. And the number one most liked RNS came from Horizonte Minerals. Of course, Jeremy was on the podcast today talking about the Araguaia Nickel Project Feasibility Study. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.